from Palestine. This is a special edition of the Green Planet Monitor, voices and stories from a warm, wet planet. Think about Palestine. Those who've been listening to the news will immediately think of last night. Iranian suicide drones and cruise missiles raining down, up and down Israel-Palestine. War is about to break out. Well, war has been going on for a while here, certainly for the last 100 years. But set aside all these ideas about Palestine as a place of conflict and violence. It's also a place of astonishing beauty and biological diversity. And I happen to be standing in one of the centers of Palestinian biodiversity, just south of Israel's eternal and undivided capital, Jerusalem, beneath the city of Bethlehem. It's a little oasis of plant and wildlife diversity. The Palestine Institute for Biodiversity and Sustainability, founded 10 years ago by Palestinian-American Mazen Kumsieh and his partner Jesse. For those who are coming to Palestine, who've never been to Palestine, and those who've been here before wish to return, will probably want to come here and visit this astonishing plot of land. It's just 3 hectares of land, just a 20-minute drive south of Jerusalem if you've got Israeli license plates on. It'll take a little bit longer if you're driving in a car with Palestinian license plates. For the past 10 years, Mazen and Jesse have been cultivating this plot of land as a haven, as an oasis for plant and animal diversity. An astonishing number of trees, fruiting trees growing here, loquat, mulberry, almond, carob, hawthorn, lemon, pecan, peach, nectarine trees, plums, pears, pomegranates, quince, and of course, lots of olive trees. Mazen and Jesse also raise animals of various sorts. There's also a really green pond, a water feature with frogs in it, and I'm looking at one of those frogs swimming along as I speak. And boy, are those guys jumping. There must be a few girls in there. And a hydroponic shed where various plants are being grown through drip irrigation, and tilapia are raised in a set of tanks which are constantly sending nutrient-rich water through a set of pipes to plants, other plants growing here, tomatoes and chard and broccoli and cauliflower. Last night, Jesse and Mazen and I prepared a bed, weeded it and removed the stones, and snake cucumber, an heirloom variety of Palestinian cucumber, renowned in the village of Beit Sahur, just a little bit east of us, is now growing, having been heavily soaked with water. And there's even a composting toilet here, where you could sit down and relax for at least a half an hour and enjoy the view. It's a very, very pleasant little spot, I must confess, though I haven't used it yet. And then dozens and dozens of species of plants, many of them flowering, most notably about a dozen species of orchid, rows and rows and rows of rosemary, and various sheds where plants are growing, with plastic bottles serving as siding and also insulation, and a vertical garden constructed out of 2.5-liter bottles. You pour water in the top and water just drips down. And then there's the chicken shed. Hey guys, there's a whole bunch of chickens here. one of which is sitting on its eggs, and there's a couple of magnificent roosters and a bunch of rabbits. They've had their breakfast and they're waiting for their afternoon snack. Amongst the most intriguing creatures here at the Palestine Institute for Biodiversity and Sustainability, the Palestine Museum of Natural History. There is a Museum of Natural History here with a library and a lab and all sorts of exhibits that kids can read, enjoy, study from. Is this enclosure with a couple of Palestinian hyenas. Hey guys, the first time you see these guys, they're actually a pair of girls. You think they're kind of unseemly, not very attractive, but the more you get to know them, the cuter they become, and they've got an interesting vocalization. They kind of bleat like sheep. So I've just spent a week here, and I've got another week to go. I'm volunteering. I spent half a day driving down to Battir, a UNESCO World Heritage Site, with Mazen and a friend. And today I sat down with Mazen Coupsier and spoke with him about his center, now celebrating its 10th anniversary here in Bethlehem on the Mar Andrea campus of the University of Bethlehem. Okay.
Okay.
Introduce yourself. Tell me who you are.
Well, I'm... how do I introduce myself? I'm a troublemaker born in that village over there called Beit Sahur. The good troublemaking. As a Palestinian born in this country, you are always under pressure. So from my childhood, I realized we have problems here and we have challenges and we have to face these challenges. We have to rise up to these challenges. We have to resist these oppressions, etc. And of course, you know, what our parents teach us, like kindness, generosity, help to others. My mother, for example, who was born also here, in the Bethlehem area and raised here, spent her 90 some years here, rarely ventured outside the country. I managed to bring her to the US in 1985 when my son was born, but that was the only time she ventured in such a country or outside the country. So anyways, she was raised here. She used to take me with her as a child to visit refugees. At the time, they were not living in either tents or caves or barracks or buildings or anything. They were living in caves and in the open, basically. And so she was giving them food and clothes, from used clothes from us. So I learned from her that we should care for each other, that we should care for the oppressed people. My family is not refugees. My grandmother on my mother's side is from Nazareth. I guess you can say I'm one quarter of a displaced person, because refugees technically are ones who live outside the country. This is what my background is. I was raised here, I was educated here, I went to a graduate school in the US, and I came back here after working in the US for a few years at universities like Duke and Yale University and others, becoming a well-known researcher and laboratory director there. I gave up all that good life, went from a six-figure income to a zero-figure income by coming back to Palestine. And that was the best decision I made in my life in 2008. So I've been here back to Palestine 16 years now. And we started, you know, to do projects here, including this institute, which we can talk about.
Tell me about the institute. Where are we? What is this place?
So this beautiful place with the, you know, here I'm sitting in the fresh air, smelling the nice flowers, and you know, it's an oasis in the middle of Bethlehem. The Zionist colonizers took most of our land. Of course, essentially 97% 97% of the land in what became the State of Israel was Palestinian land, was taken over. That's within the Green Line. Then Israel occupied the West Bank and the Gaza Strip and Sinai and the Golan Heights. So they came here in Bethlehem in 1967. This is Bethlehem where Jesus was born. Bethlehem district is a very large district. It goes from here all the way to the Dead Sea over there, which on a clear day you can actually see the mountains of Jordan there. And if you go up the roof of this building, you can actually see the Dead Sea. It's not very far, so it's a small area. Anyway, the Bethlehem district, 85% of it was taken over for Israeli Jewish-only settlements or colonies. So we're restricted to 15% of the land. And this 15% of the land, you could even videotape later, show how, because people are squeezed, they start to build vertically. So we have buildings going up all around. This remains the only open area, basically, within the city of Bethlehem, with some 400 species of plants. We introduced some plant species here in a botanic garden. We have a museum of natural history. We're building behind me, renovating an older building, making it a larger museum. This is this institute. Why did we start it? As I said, to be like an oasis in Bethlehem. But beyond that, it is a regional and even global hub for biodiversity and sustainability.
In Palestine?
No, global hub throughout the world and regional hub. What does that mean? Why the words biodiversity and sustainability in the name of the institute, Palestine Institute for Biodiversity and Sustainability? The idea is that we want sustainability of human and natural communities, and because of this, you cannot have, of course, sustainability of nature without sustaining the humans that are living in that nature, the indigenous native people. And vice versa, you cannot sustain indigenous native people, living next to a protected area, for example, without protecting that area, because we humans depend on nature.
We depend on the resources that the land provides.
The land provides, the plants provide us oxygen, they provide us with food, medicinal plants. Our ancestors never had their modern medicine. They depended on plants for medicine. They depended on these resources that we have.
And water. I mean, yes, all this vegetation,
water,
this biological diversity,
right,
holds on to water, doesn't it?
Absolutely. So this is why it's important and why this institute is important. And how does it go about doing this? So it's vision, if you want, the sustainable human and natural communities. But how does it go about doing this? That's its mission and goals. We do this in brief because of time. I mean, research, education, conservation, and community service. These are the four categories of work that we do. In research, we publish on everything from human environmental impacts to colonial activities that destroy the environment, to how we protect the environment, to pedagogy, education. How do I educate children, for example, about climate change? What species are endangered, what is not endangered? How do I protect them? Whether I protect them what's called in situ, in the location that they are present in, or ex situ, outside the location they are present. For example, we have orchids and irises here that we took from the wild and brought them here to grow them and propagate them. In case they go extinct in the wild, we can repopulate the wild with the species from here. This is the idea of conservation. We have an animal rehabilitation unit that's also conservation efforts. We do national strategies, local strategies, and also even global strategies. Some of our members, including me, are experts in conservation, so we are with the International Union of Conservation of Nature, or the Convention on Biological Diversity. We are engaged in various aspects of supporting global efforts to combat climate change and other threats to our environment. And finally, in community service, as I said, we have to protect the community. We have to make sure that our community has sustainable living. So we show them how to, sometimes it's a matter of even reviving their knowledge of how to grow things organically, not use pesticides, insecticides that damage the environment, things like that. So this is what we do in terms of community service. We help, for example, with permaculture, aquaponics, aquaculture, technical information to farmers, advice to farmers, sometimes direct help to farmers, like providing them with seeds and seedlings of native and indigenous plants. Yesterday, you and I planted, for example, some seeds of a local kind of a snake cucumber, they call it, fakus in Arabic. And this is an important way for us to propagate and grow our own food. That's what we call food sovereignty. European Union and others, they like to use food security as a word. I don't like that, food security, because food security can come also from humanitarian aid, and I don't want that. I want food sovereignty. I want to be sovereign on my food production. As an indigenous person, as a native people, we have to be able to produce our own food, which is what our ancestors did for thousands of years. This is, after all, part of the Fertile Crescent, where humans first developed agriculture.
And conversely, if I may jump in, one of the aims of the occupation, of Israel's occupation, and of any colonizing entity or colonizing force, is to alienate the indigenous people from their lands.
Absolutely.
It's not simply driving people from their lands. There will always be people, indigenous people on the land, but the idea is to alienate them from the land.
Right.
And
to make them disconnected from the land and from their heritage, even. It's sort of like the European colonizers in North America insisted that the indigenous people, what they called mistakenly American Indians or Indians, to even give them Christian names and insist they don't wear traditional clothes, that they don't use traditional methods of hunting and fishing and growing corn and things like that, that they become basically dependent on them or put in reservations where they can even starve, we don't care, or they can die by diseases that we bring, like the, blankets that are infested and things like that. This is a typical colonial attitude towards indigenous people.
And how has that played out in Palestine since 1967?
I mean, we write research about this a lot, and how the colonization impacted the local people and how it affected their lives and livelihood. But basically, today there are 15 million Palestinians, 8 million of us are refugees or displaced people, and that's not counting the 1.5 million people in Gaza that were displaced in the last 6 months, their homes demolished basically. Many of them, this is second time they become refugees or displaced people and move to Rafah area. And this is just one example. There are thousands of other examples of how they take over the land, the water, the springs, the production. Jaffa used to be a big exporter to Europe of oranges. Who are these fields of oranges belong to? Palestinians. They were all kicked out. Israel took this means of production, and they even took the label Jaffa oranges, trademark, and they stole that and export now and use that as Jaffa oranges as being Israeli when they really are stolen Palestinian orchards of oranges.
Where are we going, Mazen?
We are heading out of Bethlehem ghetto to get to a marginalized village called Battir. Battir and the area around it are part of a World Heritage Site and a very important site in Palestine. Landscape is beautiful with a lot of biodiversity. We had done some studies in the area of the valleys around Battir. This is in the South Jerusalem hills. Now, as we depart Bethlehem, we go through Beit Jala. This is now actually technically is in Beit Jala. We are now in Beit Jala. And there are three refugee camps in Bethlehem. Total population of refugees in Bethlehem is about 65,000-70,000 people. About 60% of them live in the refugee camps. 40% of the refugees live outside the camps among the local people. Total population of the Bethlehem district is 250,000 people. That includes the refugees, of course. That's Palestinians, but there is also around 200,000 Jewish colonial settlers living on the district of Bethlehem, and they control 85% of the land of the Bethlehem area. These settlements like Tekoa and Har Homa and Har Gilo, which I'll show you in a minute. So there are three refugee camps within Bethlehem city itself. There are three cities, if you want to call them cities or towns. Bethlehem is the largest with 50,000-60,000 people. And then there's Beit Jala, which is this town. Beit Jala is around 12,000 to 13,000, and Beit Sahur, which is my village, with a similar number of people. Oh shit, I hate stopping like this because I cannot start.
Well done!
The manual shift.
You always learn on a stick shift car how to start on a hill.
On a hill, and this, they stopped in the worst possible place. And then a car behind me, so I cannot make any mistakes.
Here in Bethlehem, we've got this whole region of the southern West Bank. Bethlehem, Beit Sahur, Beit Jala, Al-Walaja are all separated from Jerusalem and from these incredibly biologically diverse lands between here and Jerusalem by this ring of settlements, Har Gilo, Har Homa. Tell me about that. What impact the settlement ring around southern Jerusalem has had on native biological diversity and how you're trying to restore that.
Well, I mean, Bethlehem as a district, we wrote a paper about how biodiversity was decimated in the Bethlehem district thanks to various colonization efforts, thanks to settlements like this one that was built where there used to be a forested mountain here or hill, and how the wall impacts biodiversity, the wall isolates Palestinians from their land, how the different extraction of water from underneath our feet, the Israeli extraction of water from springs that used to be flowing springs that of course creates an ecosystem, was an ecosystem for wetlands, wildlife like frogs and dragonflies and plants of around water, etc., birds, you know, migrating birds even. When they didn't want that flowing water, so they directly extract the water from neck, you know, from inside the spring, so the water is not flowing anymore. That devastated the environment. The reason they did it, of course, was not that they devastate the environment. They knew it will devastate, but that was not the real reason. The real reason is they don't want flowing water that the Palestinians can use. So that's natural for colonial struggles. It's the same reason why the European colonizers in North America killed 2 million buffaloes, for example, to deprive the natives of this resource. So depriving indigenous native people from these kinds of resources is logical and expected in the context of colonization.
And yesterday we traveled on our way to Batir. We traveled through this valley, which I have seen on multiple occasions while taking the bus from Jerusalem to
Hebron.
To Hebron, and you go through the Gilo Tunnel, and you see on the right hand side this incredible valley, which is very. You were talking about this as one of the last remaining biologically diverse intact systems.
Now it's isolated behind the wall. Sometimes we can get through, sometimes we can't. Some roads are blocked, etc. And now they are expanding their settlements and they will destroy this valley. Al-Mahrur Valley, it's called. It's one of several valleys in the South Jerusalem hills that are very critical for biodiversity, but they are very critical biocultural landscape. What do we mean by biocultural landscape? Is these are valleys and hills that have been used by humans for thousands of years. And so the terraces, for example, in those valleys that you saw, some of them are thousands of years old, the stone terraces along the hills that people grew olive trees. Olive trees were domesticated first in our region, the Eastern Mediterranean region, which is Palestine, Lebanon, Western Syria, and South Turkey. This is where the original wild olive tree was domesticated about 5,000 years ago. And so people started building these terraces to help reclaim the land and rehabilitate land to be able to use as agricultural fields. And this is why what was successful and sustained the human population here continuously, like Batir is continuously inhabited for thousands of years. There's never been an ethnic cleansing of Batir. In other villages, there was ethnic cleansing, but not historically, only in the past 100 years. Under the Zionist project, villages like Lifta, Deir Yassin, Al-Malha, those villages in West Jerusalem were all wiped out and the people kicked out. So their way of life that survived for thousands of years was decimated in the blink of an eye, basically in 1948. This is why it's important, and when you say it's a area beautiful valley, yes, there's beautiful valleys there, biocultural landscape. We actually managed to get it on the UNESCO World Heritage Site as an important World Heritage Site between Batir, Hussein, and Beit Jala, three towns there. The two valleys around them are a World Heritage Site.
But Israel is seizing some of that land.
Israel is not only seizing it, it's destroying it. Turning it into a mini European landscape with the European settlement, colonial settlement buildings that are even with thatched roofs, like they have in Europe, what do you call them, the red roof, sloped roof.
And they're calling some of these areas natural conservation areas.
No, this particular area, they claim it as a national park.
Yeah, right.
National park, in the parlance of Israel, national means Jewish nation, because Israel is a Jewish state, is a Jewish nation. Non-Jews here, Christian, Muslim, Baha'i, Druze, are not considered human beings worthy of anything. They're not considered real, part of the nation that is the nation of Israel, that's the land of Israel. So when they say national park, it means it's a land for the Jews. That mean they will protect it for its natural design or outlook, right? Because they don't want that. As I said, they want to create a European mental picture of what Europe, Eastern Europe looks like. They want to impose it here. This is the gate that locks Bethlehem. This is an Israeli military post. Whenever they feel like to, they can lock us in our ghetto or our concentration camp or our people warehouse.
It's a very roundabout way to get to Batir from Bethlehem. If one could go straight, it would be a lot quicker, but you're taking all the back roads, aren't you?
No, Batir is not difficult to get to when the gate is open, when they let us through. I'm taking you through this valley because it's a natural area and I want to show you nature, and I want to pick up some orchids on the way if I have a chance.
And there's the wall.
This from here, you see the concept of maximum geography, minimum demography. You can see they put this Israeli only road here and the wall there that separates the people of that town, that village, Al-Khadr, from their land there. But there are Israeli settlements on both sides of the wall. And you can see here a new settlement that's starting right there, if you want to photograph it. That's what they call an outpost. So it starts with the outposts like this, and then it expands to become a full-fledged settlement.
And this area here, this is all Palestinian. Is this area?
Well, all the areas are Palestinian. It's a matter of whether they were stolen or not. I'm taking you on a safari.
This is the scenic tour.
Yeah. We'll come back through the paved road. But the reason I like to come here is we published like 6 research papers on this area. And we designated it as a new protected area. And it's the only remaining green area in Bethlehem, in the Bethlehem district. But this is considered by Israeli parlance as Area C, which is subject to Israeli civil and military control.
And in the valley beneath us, there are all these terraces, stone terraces and olive trees. Do Palestinians come here and gather olives or forage for plants?
Yes. Our ancestors built these terraces over thousands of years. Some of them are 200 years old, some are 3,000 years old. You see, this is part of the Fertile Crescent where humans first developed agriculture. So first domestication of animals and plants. happened right here.
Not in Mesopotamia.
Well, Mesopotamia is part of the Fertile Crescent.
But we're far from Mesopotamia here in Palestine. Mm-hmm.
The reason it's called Fertile Crescent is it looks like a crescent. It starts in western Iran and Iraq. This is what you call Mesopotamia in the old colonial literature. And it goes to Syria through Bilad al-Sham, which is Syria, Lebanon, and South Turkey, and into Palestine. This crescent-shaped structure is where first human evidence of agriculture, domestication of animals and plants. Plants like wheat and barley, you can see, for example, the wild wheat here and the wild barley still grows in places like this. And humans domesticated it here. That is a settlement called Har Gilo. It took land from both Bejala and the village of Al-Walaja. The village of Al-Walaja, you can see the mosque there. That's the Al-Walaja. Look at the gazelle. Gazelle, see it?
Oh yeah, there's a gazelle down there. Mazen Qumsiyye, what impact does this place have on visitors, Palestinian visitors who come here, particularly young people and students? What do they get out of this and what's their impression?
This provides, how do I describe it? An oasis of hope. It's not just an oasis of calm, it's an oasis of hope, where people see the potential for protecting our environment, the potential for caring for each other, the potential for love, the potential for peace. The potential, this Earth, by the way, planet Earth, has enough resources to feed everybody. We don't need wars and conflict. I mean, last night we woke at 2 a.m, you and I, with these missiles and counter missiles and stuff like that over Bethlehem, over Jerusalem. There's no need for that. The Israeli military, by genocide in Gaza, produced more greenhouse gases in the past 6 months than many European countries to damage the environment. I repeat that. The Israeli military alone in 6 months used more greenhouse emitting gases, petrol and stuff like that for jets, than many European countries produce in a whole year, with all their industries, with all their cars, private cars, public transportation, everything else. The military is the biggest environmental threat to humanity. And there's no reason for it. There's no logical reason for it. We could have peace here in a heartbeat if there were not greedy people who want to get to be billionaires from military-industrial complex, selling weapons, exploiting other people, and using religion and using the language of tribalism, like the Jewish people, to try and justify taking somebody else's land, property, ethnic cleansing us Palestinians. We, as I said, we Palestinians are indigenous people. We have been living here for thousands of years, regardless of religions that come and go, by the way. My family is Christian, for example. Before that, they may have been Jewish or pagan or whatever. They adopted Christianity. When Islam came here, most families adopted Islam. That's their choice, and they changed religions, and we have lived together in peace. Christian, Muslim, Jews, Baha'i, Druze, everybody else. There's no reason why we cannot do that. The only thing stopping us is a foolish, stupid idea called political Zionism, which claims that a Jewish state, is good for the Jews. It's the claim. It's a false claim, of course. It's not good for the Jews. It's the worst thing that happened to Judaism in 2,000 years. And this is not my words that I just said. These are the words of a Jewish person who said this in, Ilan Pappe in his speech. So I think we have to realize that this is not a good idea to have religions in charge of countries. No matter how good or bad these religions are, we cannot have religions in charge of country or people who claim to represent those religions to be in charge of countries. No, we can have a secular democratic country for all its people. It's very simple. It's present in many, many countries in the world.
And does this center give its visitors, its young Palestinian visitors particularly, hope and inspiration?
That's what I say. It's an oasis of peace, it's an oasis of hope, it's an oasis of conservation and environmental protection in the middle of mayhem and stupidity around us. This is why it's, for me, I'm very passionate about this institution, which my wife and I started with a group of volunteers, and it's really important.
So the Palestine Institute, this territory, this the plot of land, 1 hectare, it's really small, it's beautiful, it's packed with plants and gorgeous flowering trees and fruits and vegetables, and there's a couple of hyenas and chickens and rabbits and fish and a hydroponics garden, and it's a marvelous place to see nature blooming and to encourage it. Yeah. And it takes a lot of work to do that. But at the same time, your vision is really small and compact. It's sustaining this plot of land, but the vision is much larger.
No, this land is a demonstrative farm and demonstrative site. It demonstrates possibilities. But our work, I mean, you mentioned what am I going to do in Australia? I was invited to speak in Uganda and Egypt and United Arab Emirates and Jordan, telling them how to replicate this model, how to do it in their own country. So the idea of reaching out and replicating, already there are ideas starting in other countries. We were planning actually to do something similar to this in Gaza Strip before this war started. And so it's really, as I said, it's a model, it's replicable, it's doable in other countries.
Introduce yourself again, Mazen. And for people who have no idea where are we?
So, this is Mazen Qumsi, I'm professor at Bethlehem University, and we are in Al-Mahrur Valley, which is South Jerusalem Hills, surrounded by settlements. Jerusalem is now isolated from Bethlehem. I live in the Bethlehem district, in the Bethlehem area, but I cannot go to Jerusalem because it is now, as a Palestinian Christian, not open to us. It's open only to Jews from around the world. War destroyed.
We're coming up to Batir.
Yeah. So what's the history of Batir? Batir goes back to Canaanitic habitation, maybe earlier, because we also saw evidence of human dwellings going back to the Bronze Age and Iron Age, before the invention of writing and before we have any evidence of so-called civilizations, before agriculture, hunter-gatherers, and even before the Iron and Bronze Age, we have the Stone Age. We have Homo erectus here, stones from Homo erectus, which came up. Humans came out of Africa to the rest of the world through waves of migration through Palestine.
were coming into Battir.
Yeah. So Battir is an ancient community of Palestinians, of people here, indigenous people. The more modern era of Battir, we know that it has always, for thousands of years, depended on agriculture. So for the past 200 years also, depended on agriculture. Eight large hamulas, we call them, original families, now more than one sub-family under them. And those people have this land that they used to cultivate, as you see here, and are still cultivating it. Most of the farming here is done by women. So the way they do it is they collect all the water here, and then they distribute it to one family a day. So one family a day gets the water. So the Battiri week is actually 8 days because there are eight families and the rotation goes, right? So for example, let's say this plot belongs to one family. So whatever they have ways that they can cut off. Before even Israel was created in the 1920s, when they had the beginning of the British mandate here, the Zionists started, with the help of the British, taking over Palestinian water, including diverting the water of the Jordan River and other things. They realized that the water is a strategic asset. No life for the indigenous people without water. So they basically started also taking the springs after 1967 when they occupied this area. But because this particular spring, you can see, is surrounded by Palestinian houses, and this village was not ethnically cleansed, then they were forced to let the people keep their water. That's why they enjoy swimming and using the water for their fields and things like that. In the 1948 period, in April 1948, when Israel massacred a lot of people in West Jerusalem, a lot of villagers, and ethnically cleansed most of those villages, including Al-Walaja, Deir Yassin, Liftau, all these areas that are now in what's called West Jerusalem, Jewish West Jerusalem. They ethnically cleansed all of those, and this village, all its people also left the village in April 1948. And they went to Bethlehem. They were afraid because of the massacre. So there was an educated person here who's like a mukhtar or head of the village council. His name is Hassan Mustafa. And Hassan Mustafa, he went to the place where the refugees were sitting and he said to them, look, you should come back to the village. Because if we leave, they're going to take it over. And we cannot allow them to take it over. And the military is still not there. The military was on top of that hill there. So he didn't manage to convince very many. He convinced like maybe a dozen young people. And he was himself young. He was in his early 30s when this happened. And so he brought these 12 people to the village. And what they did is they, each evening, they would light up all the village house, not electricity, of course, at the time, it's kerosene lamps. So they would light up all the houses in the village and they would make a lot of noise. They turn radios on, things like that, and make it look like the village is populated and defended even. You know, they'd put dummies and stuff like that. And the soldiers up on that hill would think that this village is not conquered yet. So as he would send those young people and say, look, we've been in the village for 10 days, nothing happened, 12 days, 2 weeks. Slowly the villagers started coming back. And by the time Israel was declared in May 15, 1948, this village was largely repopulated from the people who left it. And so then the Israeli military wanted to draw borders. So obviously that's when the story of this railroad track came in, because Israeli commander and a young commander by the name of Yitzhak Rabin came and met with this village head, Hassan Mustafa. And he said, what do you want? And Hassan Mustafa said, well, what do you mean, what do I want? I want to live in my land, and this is my land, and this is our village land. And the Israeli commander said to him, well, we need the railroad, and the railroad passed through your village. He said, well, I don't care. You know, the railroad has never been molested before and will never be molested, but we have to be able to cross the railroad to get to our land on the other side of that area. So they actually drew the maps in Rhodes in 1949 and incorporated this aspect in the agreement between Israel and Jordan for ceasefire, not a peace agreement then, it was a ceasefire agreement. So Hassan Mustafa is looked at as a hero of this village, actually have saved the village, because its fate would have been similar to the village of Al-Walaja, which was, I think, cleansed, or Lifta, which had a beautiful spring. Lifta would be exactly like this, but you go now there in Lifta and West Jerusalem, it's ruins, basically. Israel depopulating.
Tell me about the pine trees on that side. It's all pine trees.
Yeah, that's,
and here it's biodiversity, there it's monoculture.
Yes, that's what the colonizers do. They basically they destroy agro-biodiversity, they destroy human diversity, and they want to create a Jewish state with European trees, pine trees. I mean, you can see pine trees here, but there's two or three pine trees. There's actually three different species of local pine trees. You can see them there. Well, Israel destroyed all these villages on the other side of the Green Wall. They leveled all these trees, whether domestic trees like figs and almonds and olives, or wild trees like carobs and hawthorn and things like that. And in place of this agro biodiversity, they planted the monoculture of Pinus halepensis, which is a European pine tree.
Last question, how can people help? What can people do to help?
Go to our website, palestinenature.org. You can either volunteer your efforts, in-kind donations, books, material, specimens. You can donate your time, obviously, whether here you can come as a volunteer like you did and spend time with us. We provide with volunteers here with room and board, so it's nice and comfortable and beautiful surrounding. Or they can donate cash if they wish to. Also on our website you can find the tabs for volunteering and donating and everything else. Spreading the word is very important. Even if you don't volunteer or you don't donate, networking and connecting us with others, if you know people in Australia or New Zealand or South America, where I'm going next at the end of the year, is a possibility to help us networking people. Thanks.
Mazen Kumsiye, thank you so much.
Thank you.
What are we doing here?
So you have to plant those seeds in this bed, but we have to weed it first.
Okay.
So I've been digging it, you can see. And then Jesse or you, with the milder form, can pick up those weeds and stuff. But sometimes.
What seeds are we planting?
This is a cucumber, snake cucumber.
It's traditional Palestinian?
Yeah, traditional Palestinian cucumber. So, I need to take out the stones that are here too. So.
Okay, so.
So you want to help, you want to dig, you want to plant, which do you want?
I want to do both. Can I do both?
Yeah, that'd be great.
Can I dig and plant and remove stones?
Yes, let's do it. Well, we have to divide the work. I only have one pickaxe. So why don't you start by digging, because I've been digging and I'm exhausted. I want to go weed a little and then we switch.
Do you get exhausted?
Yes. Yeah, I'm an old man. What can I tell you?
So why don't you let me do this heavy stuff?
Okay. Now if you get some soil with it, you can put it back.
To learn more about the Palestine Institute for Biodiversity and Sustainability and Associated Palestine Museum of Natural History, go to greenplanetmonitor.net. We'll link to the Institute's website. That's it for today's special edition of the GPM, a listener-supported podcast coming to you from Earth Chronicle Productions in Palestine. Listen to, read, and watch more Earth stories at greenplanetmonitor.net. Find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube, and our home base, Blueberry. We're also on Facebook and Twitter, and Canada's Harbinger Media Network. Wherever or however you're listening, reading, or watching, please help us make the GPM happen. Subscribe and or donate at greenplanetmonitor.net. By the way, the guy behind this guitar is Dan Weisenberger. Thanks for your fabulous instrumental themes, Dan. I'm David Kattenberg, over and out for now.